Shouldn't have done that. It's fine. Hello. Hi, Kieran.
Hi, Yanni.
Ready to talk about Albo?
Very excited, actually.
All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to Shouldn't Have Come, a podcast about why it wasn't worth doing all of this. We are here to complete our trifecta of the big three states of Australian politics and introduce the man with the highest pants in the land, Prime Minister Anthony Albo Albanese.
Woo! Albo, Albo, Albo.
Albo.
He's at it again, everybody. We've met Melbourne Bill, like the city himself, an unserious figure that's slick on camera, but I've written substantially substanceless, and I really think a lot about my ability to read. But he's substantially substanceless. We flew up north to meet Brisbane Pete, his underwear and socks filled with the coarse soil of the Australian outback and the broken ground of his rental properties. But we're going to take the Pacific Highway south today to where it all, and by it, I mean all this bullshit, started. Welcome to Sydney.
Sydney, capital of New South Wales.
You were born in Sydney.
I was born in Sydney. I was born in Hurstville.
Do you like Sydney?
I was, for the longest time, a really big fan of Sydney because it wasn't Canberra. And out of the two places that I knew Sydney and Canberra. And I was like, well, Sydney's clearly better. Having gotten older and been to other places, Sydney ain't shit.
No,
like, Sydney ain't shit.
Fuck Sydney. And it's in shitty fucking Sydney that Anthony Albanese is born. But who is Anthony Albanese? Because right now, he's the sitting Prime Minister, having assumed office on the 23rd of May, 2022. His popular image is that of a pragmatic, working-class, Irish-Australian, footy-loving, beer-with-him-having council estate boy with a funny voice that he uses to sing music with guitars in it. Yeah.
I think that tracks, yeah.
Yeah. He's Sydney working class. He's from a single-parent family. He got upward mobility through discipline, hustle, and education, and rose all the way to the top. And, you know, there's three currents in the Anthony Albanese story, three nodes that come up at every intersection of his life, and the three tenets that he publicly avows as the roots of his success above all others. One, his commitment to long-term Labour government. Long-term Rod Labour government. Two, his love for his mother and her Catholic teachings. And three, the South Sydney Rabbitohs National Rugby League Club.
Up the Rabbitohs.
Up the Rabbitohs. It's tempting to write a story of a practical, hard-left electoralist doing what has to be done to get what's needed to be gotten. The socialist magazine Jacobin would disagree with that, though. Painting a picture of a transactionalist and collaborationalist with Labour's right wing, dedicated to Albo for PM. Is he a bumbling, aesthetically Catholic working-class dad who wants his constituents to have a fair go? The conservative magazine The Spectator's unhinged Stephen Fryson invoked Poznan and Ukraine to label him a committed, atheist, leftist socialist. So maybe what's left is a somber, statesman-like warrior, treating the office of the Prime Ministership with the requisite honour and respect. Or maybe he's a fucking nerd. And he loves politics. He loves doing politics and processing in politics. And he loves telling these stories of old battles when plucky little Albo outsmarted the evil factions. And because all the mates he's had battles with form the skeleton of Australian politics, he gets to keep telling them forever. And when I say all the mates, I mean all the mates. Some of Australian politics' most odious figures seem to somehow, beyond all available evidence, count themselves a friend to Albo. Because Albo is the Labour Party. But he's Albo. And he's been Albo for a very long time. He's been Albo since the 60s. And he'll be Albo forever.
Dun dun!
Thanks. Yeah. So, listen, we gotta start with our sources before we get into Albo's parents. My main source, the structural source for the episode, is Albanese Telling It Straight by Karen Middleton. Karen is a long-term political journalist, and I only learned at the end of research that she went to the same high school I did. She's worked for the SBS and the ABC, and been a correspondent for Al Jazeera, 7, 9, The Works. She's currently the political editor of The Guardian, and more than a few of her articles are sources for this episode, too. Her book covers up till about 2016, at which point I flipped to Lone Wolf by Catherine Murphy. Catherine Murphy used to work...
Lone wolf.
Sorry about that, everyone. Archie was barking. Catherine used to work for The Guardian as well, but now she works for Anthony Albanese.
No way.
So my eyebrow was raised slightly higher at her piece, and although both are generally gentle with Albo, Catherine definitely gets a bit glazier, as it were. There's other sources, which in theory will be in the description of this episode, but we're going to get back to our story, and the source of our story is Albanese's parents. Marianne Ellery was born circa 1937, and is described as a perennially unwell child after an early illness. Fourth of five kids in a classic Irish-Australian family, Marianne starts working at 13 as an usherette, terminology which we've discussed. I don't understand, like, it's a verb. It's a verb.
Yeah.
Just, like, at? Why?
Just usher.
So in 1962, Marianne joins her older brother George on the Fairski cruise liner, where George is working as an entertainer. The Ellery family are described as having fine singing voices overall. The Fairski was designed as a British assault ship but for World War II, but by the 60s, it's doing cruise laps between jolly old England and cheeky young Australia. Migrants coming from the Isles would get super subsidized tickets. This is where the term 10-pound poms comes from, and you...
That's the side of my mum.
That's your mum's side. As outflows of the populate or perish policy of the Australian government. Families such as John and Moira Gillard, travelling from Wales with their daughters Alison and Julia, were drawn into the warmer weather and potential stability and employment, riding the fair skis to the growing ports of Australia. Mm. So, same cruise liner that the Gillards came here.
Damn.
For Australians, the fair ski, though, promises adventure. Although the fares were much more expensive on the fair ski, it's worth it for Marianne to be able to leave Sydney, see Europe, bond with her brother, and meet all manner of interesting people. The fair ski called Genoa home, and a handsome 31-year-old Italian steward named Carlo steals Marianne's heart.
31-year-old?
And a handsome 31-year-old Italian steward named Carlo Albanese steals Marianne's heart.
Ooh, summer fling.
Oh, she's
romance.
She's wearing cheongsam dresses in Singapore. There's gems in Colombo. There's an April Fool's Day party in the Suez Canal. Who wouldn't fall in love? Some ships have rules about this sort of thing, but Carlo's boss was typically Italian. A lot of ships made a point to hire gay stewards to prevent this, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah, but not Carlo's boss. And in 1962, Elvis's Can't Help Falling in Love floods the world's airways. So I'll just show you a picture. In this picture, you'll see Carlo and Marianne. Carlo's in the white suit standing up, and Marianne's sitting down on the very left. Tell me about these two.
Okay, Carlo looks like he's absolutely a good time. He's got, like, a cheeky grin on his face. He's actually quite handsome. He's got really dark hair, nice thick eyebrows. He looks like someone you would really want to, like, have fun with. He looks like comforting fun. Like, he's not going to be like, let's go dirt biking. He's going to be like, hey, let's go play some pool. Let's have a couple bevvies. Let's, like, hang out, you know? Maybe we'll walk across the beach and watch the sunrise.
Aw, Carlo.
Like, he feels like he's, like, cheeky romantic.
And what about Marianne?
Marianne, she's actually, like, she's not facing the camera, so I don't get as much, like, you know, from her. But she's really well done up. Her hair looks great. She looks like she's got, like, a great glow going on from all of her traveling. She looks really beautiful. She looks like she's having a great time. Like, you know, I think that's, like, really sweet. I like that they're on opposite sides of the picture as well.
Yeah.
And there's... I like that that's, like, oh, you know, like a tantalizing little, you know, detail.
Well, there's not many pictures of them together, but by October of that year, Marianne is very much pregnant.
Hell yeah, queen.
Carlo is a steward on her journey back to Australia, and, you know, she's hoping he's going to stay, but Carlo is betrothed.
Oh, shit.
He is engaged to marry a presumably Albanian girl from his hometown, and he has to do it.
Albanian, you say?
Yeah, so Albanese just means Albanian in Italian. Anywho, the story that Marianne's family settled on is that she'd come back to Australia a young widow. A gorgeous Italian steward swept her off her feet. They got married, and then he died in a car crash.
Yep.
Lives on through the name that she takes. Marianne Albanese.
Albanese, you say?
Like, from Albany, I guess.
I guess so.
They learned to pronounce it right eventually. Albanese, although some people would say Albanese as well. So, that's Anthony in her tummy. She's alone. She's moved back to her parents' house, number 41 Permont Bridge Road, which is where she lives for the rest of her life. And Anthony Norman Albanese is born on the 2nd of March, 1963, which is... He's a Pisces. It's the year of the rabbit. No father is recorded on his birth certificate, which actually saves him during the parliamentary eligibility crisis.
Oh, that's insane.
And he's named after his mother's cousin, Anthony, who actually did die in a car crash.
Okay, all right.
He's always been Albo, though. His best friend, Lindsay, says he doesn't remember ever calling him anything else, and they've known each other since they were five or so. He was another resident of the Camperdown Estates housing, and they were inseparable little kids. But when Albo wasn't running around with Lindsay, he was spending many of his evenings watching sports with his grandpa, inheriting a fandom of the South Sydney Rabbitohs. Do you know what a Rabbitoh is?
I don't know what a Rabbitoh is. Is it just like, oh, look at those Rabbitohs out there, you know, that they hop and they... Oh, they're killing our crops.
They're killing our crops. And no, actually, a Rabbitoh is a term for someone who deals with that. A job that no longer exists. A guy that kills rabbits and offers you parts of their flesh while wandering the streets. The story goes that many of these men played for the South Sydney team that wore green. And it being a hard-working, adults-only, no-pussy-shit, deliver-your-baby-on-the-court type of team, they'd wear their uniforms while rabbit rustling. By the time they'd reach training or the game or whatever, there's blood all over their green jerseys, but... Yeah, this is probably apocryphal, that sounds ridiculous, but it's apparently the reason they wear green jerseys with red stripes on them.
That's wild.
Yeah. Albo is hoisted from shoulder to shoulder of big old blokes wearing this kit as he watches the Rabbitohs at the 1971 Grand Final as a 8-year-old. With former Wharfie George Piggins leaving it all on the pitch to take the Souths to a tight 16-10 victory. The Souths are also very associated with Sydney's working class.
Okay.
A lot of people, you know, obviously from their roots as Rabbitohs, and now there's Wharfies, lots of union people. But in another life, Albo, with his hefty frame, might have been a great scrum half.
Yeah, he would have been a great ball footer.
Ball footer, yeah. I mean, he was born in the year of the rabbit, and it only makes sense that he'd play for a team dedicated to rabbit distribution?
Hell yeah, actually, that connection is so funny.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess that's why in this world he has to grow up fast. Because around that grand final, when he's seven or so, his grandfather dies, and his mother marries a man named Jim Williamson, who immediately turns into a monster. The marriage lasts 10 weeks.
Oh, shit.
I was writing this episode for longer. Marianne develops arthritis when she's in her 30s, and Albo does a lot of looking after her and his grandma growing up, as the only other person in the house. He's managing finances, rent, and bills by the time he's about 12. He's got himself a paper round as well, getting $16 a week to hawk the Sun and the Mirror to supplement his mother's disability pensions. He is a very working-class, campered-down boy. At one point, he gets into boxing. Who doesn't? He fights...
Yeah, who doesn't, you know?
Yeah.
Out of the two people in this room, one of us has gotten into boxing.
Hey, is everyone excited for the Jake Paul-Mike Tyson fight? By the time you hear this, it'll be over.
Who won? Guys, who won?
I think Mike Tyson's going to win round four by knockout.
I think Mike Tyson's going to rip both of Jake.
He's going to rip every beard hair out of his face.
He's going to rip off both of his ears.
Rip off all his skin.
Well, yeah, he's just going to eat him.
He's going to eat him alive.
Eat him, yeah.
He's going to flay him. He's going to turn him into shawarma. Anyway, so Albo's got into boxing because he had to fight some guys off for his bike. They beat the shit out of him, and they do fuck the bike up a little. And Albo goes to the cops, and they take him to the assailant's house. They kind of shake the kids down, and the parents just pay cash right there to fix the bike. Albanese calls this old-school policing, and ends up boxing at the Glebe Police Boys Club while he grows up.
I wonder, and maybe this is obviously for later episodes, really interesting to see how this is, you know, how crime, youth crime, is handled. In Albanese's youth versus right now, where it's like, why don't we just line them up and shoot them?
I'm really excited for when we're all going to get to go to Suncorp Stadium and watch them...
execute a 12-year-old.
They're going to get Brett Lee to hit these kids' heads out of the Gabba.
Oh, that's crunched. And when he hits them, they go a long way.
You know?
Before they demolish it.
Fuck.
Anyway, a lot of people around him, especially Marianne, this is Albo, not Bradley, say he's going to be Prime Minister one day. He's responsible and he can remember a lot of information, and at this point, it's mainly sports stats. As a sport, that's mostly just statistics with the occasional gif. Albo spends a lot of time playing cricket in the backyard of his council flat with his best friend, Lindsay.
Hell yeah, Lindsay.
He used to pretend to be Desmond Haynes, the legendary West Indian batsman. At the time, the West Indies were dominating world cricket. However, he never played on a proper cricket team. You needed a car to play cricket. Cricket's definitely a rich man's sport compared to rugby, and since the rugby teams he played for sucked, nobody's arguing about this. The big thing Albo takes from is sports is the memorization of the large swaths of information produced by the gameplay. That's the big thing.
Okay. Okay. When, yeah. That's some nerd shit, but okay.
Big nerd shit. When he watches sports with his grandpa as a baby, Pop would quiz him about random stats, and he probably didn't realize that he was going to create a number psycho.
Yeah, yeah.
Camperdown, at this time though, is a very Labour Party kind of area. When he's 9 years old, Albo and Marianne are pamphleteers for Gough Whitlam's successful prime ministerial campaign. Huh. He attended local Labour Party meetings from when he was quite young, progressive political education spearheaded by Marianne. She's not aligned with any particular faction and makes her politics based on Catholic social justice principles. So the rights of women, the rights of Indigenous Australians, and generally treating others with respect. She also clues him on to the dangers of factionalism and made sure Albo steered clear of some of the union's rougher enforcers, as you know. By 1975, Albo's 12, and he's travelling with Bill McMillan and his wife. Bill is a father figure to Albo, an alderman on the city council with no kids on his own. And Albo is with him when he collapses in their first night of their trip to Gosford.
Oh shit.
Little Anthony runs across the street to find a local nurse, but it's too late. Uncle Bill, one of many surrogate father figures to Albo, is dead at age 51. So his early teen years are spent dealing with the ravages of age and watching an apathetic healthcare system treat his mother as excess. At some point, Lil Albo is trying to explain to the doctor that yes, Marianne's nervous system is dying and she's on the wrong dose of medication and that's probably why she's dying. And he's like 15.
Fucking hell.
So it's a meticulously organized, world-weary young man that manages the Albanese household. And Marianne reckons she's seen enough. She has to tell him the truth. The boy is ready to hear about the fact that his father, Carlo Albanese, did not die in a car crash, but in fact lives somewhere in Italy to this day with his family.
Damn, that's gotta be so heavy, having dealt with all of that, to then also have your mum be like, also, by the way, your dad is alive, teehee.
Yeah.
He's in Italy. Sorry.
Do you like Italy? You could go there one day. I don't know where he is, though. He never replied to my letter.
Fuck.
Although, not to besmirch Carlo necessarily, it's unlikely he received it.
Fair.
I think it sounds
this
like she kind of.
Is the 70s at this
point?
This
kind of is the 70s, and it sounds like she kind of sent it to just like Naples.
She's like, God, I hope this finds Carlo.
Carlo in Naples. But the news of his father is confusing to Albo, but it doesn't change the calculus of his life. It's him and Mum, and since Dad doesn't want Albo, Albo doesn't want Dad.
Fair enough.
Marianne sounds from every account like a wonderful mother, and a big part of why Albo was able to elevate his station in his life so dramatically. So, when Albo's at St. Mary's High School, one of his teachers sources him and some mates to act as formal dates for her younger sister, which I don't think should be allowed, but whatever. Albo and company down some passion pops and catch the train to Sydney Uni, where an up-and-coming local band was the night's entertainment. Albo fell in love with their politically charged music and their lead singer's idiosyncratic dancing. He follows them around to a few gigs, once sleeping on the beach after missing the last train home. We're going to meet this singer again in about 20 years, though you might have guessed who he is already.
Oh, God, I hope so.
I reckon you know we'll get to it, probably episode 2, I think that one's.
Hell yeah.
But enough about all that. By the time Albo's enrolled in uni, he's already a member of the Labour Party. He's not particularly impressed by any faction in the leadership, but the 1980 bashing of Peter Baldwin, allegedly by a Labour right member in response to Baldwin's allegation of corruption, did endear his sympathies somewhat with Labour left. He recalls the first conference after Baldwin's return, at which the Labour right aligned elements of the crowd jeered and booed Baldwin, who was still the worse for wear for his injuries. And I saw a photo. He looks fucked.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, he was absolutely fucked up.
Jesus.
Albo around this time is certainly remembered as an empathetic and kind person and finds this shocking. Just on a human level, he's like,
you can't bash
a motherfucker like that. But while at uni, he moves from his sort of working-class Catholic roots to a more modern left ideology, especially as he joins Young Labour. He's often found on a megaphone. He's rallying for land rights, for Palestinian rights, against the apartheid state in South Africa. Very early on, he picks up the cause of gay rights, enough to get some whispers about his own sexuality going around, but this is a man who listens to music, so in the 80s, like, that's queer behavior.
Yeah.
He also works a bunch of weird jobs, drinks beer, plays pretty good pool. He meets people on their own terms, and the arrow of his networking pierces through the softest part of his heart, wanting to care for his mom. So in the second year of uni, a mate comes around. This mate's dad was a mayor in a wealthier part of Sydney, Hunter's Hill, which has never seen a Labour Party mayor, Sir Albo describes it.
Damn.
That uni mate, Mark Jones, sees Marianne not able to cut her food and asks, I quote, "How long has that been like that?" It turns out Mark's mum works for Dr. David Champion, who is now an Order of Australia winning surgeon. David takes Marianne as a patient in the public system and reconstructs her hands. Albo describes it as making her healthier at 60 than she was at 40, and he says he learned from this that there were rich people who were good people.
That's an absolute lesson to learn from that. Shouldn't the lesson be, if there was a solution to the agony my mum's been suffering this whole time, why the fuck wasn't that an option?
I have a feeling
until I met a rich kid.
I think that's probably the lesson he learned at the time, and I think this is how he's telling the lesson to Karen in 2016.
I guess that makes sense, because, I mean, he's a rich people now, exactly. You know? So he's like, rich people are okay, because I'm now rich people.
Exactly. I mean,
maybe. And I'm okay.
And he's okay. But I wonder. You know, I mean, it's hard to know.
Maybe he's just a better person than I am. My first thought is just like, man, fuck all of y'all. That could have been solved.
That could have been solved, and this guy's doing other things instead of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Look, he's going to need a doctor soon, though, because in 1982, he's hit by a car while riding a motorbike.
Fuck off.
It is a pretty cut-and-dry case. He's on the back of his friend's bike, and a Telstra van turns illegally in front of them. Albo goes over the van. He's flung about a block, and he ends up at hospital in an ambulance. By the time the hospital stay, medication, and physio fees were paid, the resulting court case left Albo with $27,000.
Oh, shit. Payout.
But enough about that. We're going back to union politics, because the president of the Australian Union of Students in 1982 is Julia Gillard.
Oh shit, Julia Gillard!
She, of course, remembers Albo from the time, and is one of the few people who describes him as not one of her closest friends in Parliament. She describes him as having a particular disdain for people who had lived lives of privilege as children, but then became interested in left politics.
And fair enough, King.
And fair enough, even though that's me, and fair enough. As pretty boyo, she says he's boyo, keen to give it to people.
Give it to him.
All right,
you know he had to do it to him.
You know he had to give it to him one time. At this time, the council is trying to mobilise support for an affiliation with the Australian Union of Students. Albanese runs successfully for the Student Representative Council, and forever a good Irish Catholic rabbit union boy, he joins the ALP Club, who are pro-affiliation. Now, Julesy's trying to steal the Julia Gillard. Julesy. I call her Julesy, we're friends. She's trying to steer the student union away from international issues and back to education policy and student services. Although the union had been formed in part as a protest against the Vietnam War, and thus also against conscription of uni students in the union, without the active threat to day-to-day life of conscription, the average student was disengaging with the union. That's how she sees it, at least. Albo says that she was being used by right-wing groups who wanted to weaken the left's influence by getting campuses out of the union. Julia specifically calls out Palestine as a cause that the left activists cared about that the rank and file didn't. It's a canard at this point, but keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Now, I hate having to get to mathematics, but this is when we're going to have to reduce some factions again. At this time, the milieu of factions includes Labour's left and right, the communist left, modern liberals, and Jewish students, and that's a quote from the book. Albo is a Labour left kind of guy, but is only vaguely attached to the hard left Medleys, and the Medleys are one of the unions, the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. At this point, he's a member of Young Labour and dedicated to the party on the whole, so he supports the affiliation on those principles, creating a bigger Labour union. He becomes friends with Mark Butler, who is affiliated with the soft left Miso sub-faction. That's the Liquor, Hospitality, and Miscellaneous Workers Union. And he starts forging a unified democracy with March. However, the eventually successful opposition campaign to this was largely run by the Labour right-affiliated Australian Council of Jewish Students, which is what the book says. I'm not saying anything. While Albo is on the SRC, though, one of his co-members was from the Conservative Democratic Club. Her name is going to send shivers down your spine. Christine.
Oh no!
Abbott.
Oh no!
So she doesn't actually play any part in this story. I just find it interesting that she's here as well. And we need to talk about the soft left and hard left thing. It was something that's very annoying to read about in the book. But essentially, the soft left's base is activists, and the hard left's base is unions.
Okay, so it's the... Okay. It's, you know what? That kind of does make sense to me.
It seems more like your socialization than necessarily the politics, although sometimes they disagree.
Yeah, it seems like very much like a... Probably people who disagree on the way of going about things rather than the things themselves. They're like, yeah, we all want, you know, better education system.
Yeah.
The soft might protest and the union might be like, okay, teachers strike
yeah.
or whatever.
Exactly. That's the difference.
It's a different form of protest.
Exactly. The soft left aren't like centrist left or something like that, which is kind of what that sounds like. But yeah, Christine Abbott doesn't actually matter. Hard and soft left. Right now, none of that matters because... Albo's worried about the student council elections. He's running for the presidency, and he's finding himself in little dust-ups with Jim Salim, the 27-year-old Lebanese neo-Nazi convicted of firebombing a Maoist bookshop.
What?
And,
Okay, Albo's... I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a character. We'll need to look up one day, but right now he's just Albo's challenger for the SRC.
Insane.
Albo's, mad at him because Salim had been putting up some pro-apartheid posters.
Yeah, that's not good.
Jim advocates for the preservation of a self-contained, predominantly white nation resistant to further immigration or watering down of its culture. Again, I think that's beautiful from a Lebanese man.
I was going to say, again, just clarifying, he's Lebanese?
Predominantly white is what he says.
Okay.
It's important.
Right. Okay.
It's very,
okay. It's a caveat. It's like, you know what, mostly.
Mostly
not
white.
Not fully, but mostly.
But not Jim, you know. The eventual winner of this, Belinda Neal, is currently head of the Labour Party of the Central Coast. But in the Stop the Steal kind of move... Albo's ALP club alleges election irregularities, and the results are thrown out until another election can be held the following year. And that brings us to the big political economy class war of 1983, and that is political economy class war, not political economy class war. Because Albo is going to get embroiled in this course dispute. Now, they usually teach establishment economics at university. I studied it. That shit sucked. And political economy was where students could learn about Marxism and socialism. And students wanted more of this, but the administration of the university and teachers wanted less of this. And the dispute had been going on for years. It reached a fever pitch over the previous decade and has attracted some of Australia's best and brightest to weigh in on the debate. See if you can guess who these next couple of quotes are from. In 1975, the arguments had reached the public, and the university was starting to sweat at the questionable press that was being generated. A student council representative from the law faculty approached Professor Frank Stilwell, offering to mediate the situation. "I think this dispute needs somebody to be a peacemaker, a negotiator, and I'm willing to play that role." Who do you reckon?
Oh my god, I don't know.
Stilwell only recalls saying... "Good luck to you, Malcolm, to future Prime Minister
Turnbull."
Turnbull? Yep.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that actually tracks so much.
Well, when asked later, Turnbull says he doesn't remember saying it, but says, "I am, after all, a man of peace and moderation."
Oh my god, shut up.
Such a fucking woo. Anyway, not all students are so conciliatory with the political economy faculty. In 1979, the then student council president was on record saying that political economy is a thinly disguised attempt by Marxist academics to impose simplistic ideological solutions upon students to destroy the moral and intellectual standards of the elite, and that it focused on issues like feminism, which were so much nonsense.
Yucky, feminism, ew.
We've already met this character's sister, but that's an early window.
Oh, fuck, is that Tony Abbott?
Big Tony experience.
Ah.
He's here
also
too.
Makes complete sense.
Of course he's here. And anyway, another 4 years or so later, we're back where we started this diversion, and Albo is getting involved in the protests, and the stunts are going wild. One thing leads to another, you know how these things go, and the tactical response group is knocking at the door of the room, while 15 young activists, including Hot Albo, are passing a talking stick around in a circle. They've occupied somewhere. Albo describes it as forerunners of the Greens, wanting to hold hands and go kumbaya, and he shows his frustration with the lack of movement, but he wants the media play. So he's negotiating with the police through an open window on the rooftop. This sounds fun. And the crew has dragged things out long enough to get cameras and reporters on site. He's imagining he's going to walk out, police either side, probably raising his fist in the air. Floppy hair all tussled as he's stuffed into the back of a cruiser.
Hell yeah, this guy's a revolutionary,
he's a revolutionary,
you know? This guy's a rebel with a cause.
And as he's dreaming about that, the cops jump out from the stairwell they're hiding in, outside of the cameras, and swarm the kids, pushing and shoving and huffing and puffing and jostling and wrestling to ensure the upstart students didn't threaten to live their protest with dignity.
Well, and that's just how cops are.
So this is a kind of relationship police have with student protesters in the grand sweep of Australian university protest history, and you can see the same hatreds, biases, characters, and skeptics on display. Karen Middleton and Albo describe anarchists, environmentalists, and other far-left types instituting consensus decision-making. Have you ever seen many decisions made by consensus in political movements?
Like, put it to a vote and it's unanimous?
Yeah. And, you know, Labour...
Not really. Everybody's kind of...
You need a conscience vote to allow it not to be unanimous, because it's a rule that you have to
vote party lines, yeah.
Yeah, which I guess is like... We are having consensus whether you like it or not.
I was like, well, all right.
So Al Albert hates it. So they start another sit-in at an office. It's not important. He's immediately seeing the same Kwanzaa bra shit he hates. They had no strategy for it to end, he bemoans later. It became clear that the sit-in was the objective. It was literally a place to live. Him and the ALP club, the Alpineers, decide it's time for good old-fashioned politics. Knowing that these greenly lefty types tend to sleep in, they all show up early in the morning and demand an immediate vote to go home. We stacked it, basically, Albo says now, and it's a checkpoint of his life. I want outcomes rather than process.
Damn, alright.
Yeah, so the protest isn't really successful, but it's not unsuccessful. Albo has a difficult relationship with the media. He's a willing operator, but often frustrated by its infinite dimensions. In this incident, however, the PR disaster of all the hearings meant that the university had to allow the course to continue and didn't suspend any of the students. But, in a bitch-made move, they hold the hearings during exam session. So Albert does what we all should have done, and drops the subject. He takes an extra year to finish his degree, and still walks out of the university with a Bachelor of Economics in 1984. I'm just really mad about all the people whose names I heard, others that I didn't include here, that cut their teeth protesting for or against this one course at this one university or this one club or whatever. I don't know how they were all there.
Yeah, like, what the fuck? These are all people that are genuine household names, like Tony Abbott, former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, former Prime Minister, fucking Anthony Albanese, current Prime Minister. Like, why the fuck are they all there? Julia Gillard's there, former Prime Minister. Why the fuck are they all there?
Everyone. Well, this is a big thing. So this incident is kind of marked as, like, when a lot of the relationships that still hold coalesce. Like, the University of Sydney student politics is how you get into professional politics.
This honestly feels like, this to me gives the same energy as, like, honestly, Naruto.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna, like, it's like they're all kids and they're all in the same grade and there's all the different classes or whatever. And then, you know, we time jump and it's like, oh, these are the, like, new leaders or whatever. And it's like, that's kind of fucking silly. How does life work like that? That's like a fucking, like, story narrative device.
Yeah. I think that's
stupid.
I think that's because that's how we understand, as Australians, and I hesitate to say we, but as Australians, we love a simple story of a kid defying the odds. Like, we really are a shonen anime-ass country.
That's true,
like,
actually.
Like, look at Shane Warne.
Look at him. And just have a fucking look at him.
After Shane Warne, the Australian cricket team, every couple of months, picked another guy being like, and this guy is going to surprisingly be really good, like Shane Warne was. And none of them were, because it was surprising when Shane Warne was.
There will never be another Shane Warne.
It was a surprise, motherfucker. You can't plan one.
Exactly. It's like, what we're going to do, we'll pick other, like, probably shit dudes. Anyway, so we're done with uni, thankfully. We're in the Young Labour era. Tom Uren is a beloved figure in Australian left politics. He's a big brute of a man. He's at 93, he towers over Albo. In his early life, he's a professional rugby player, then a swimmer, then a boxer. And then he was in the Australian Army. He was in a POW camp run by the Japanese in Timor early in World War II. Then he worked on the Burma Railway for a few years, and then they take him to Japan, and he's there to see the sky bleed as the fat man was dropped on Nagasaki, ending the war. Urin entered the House of Representatives in 1958 for the seat of Reid in Western Sydney, and he's still holding that seat in 84, by which time he is father of the House.
Papa!
That's the person who's been in Parliament longest is known as the father of the House.
Aww.
I hate this.
Daddy home.
Daddy home. He's a passionate advocate for increased housing and a detractor of the Vietnam War, conscription, and nuclear testing. He was accused of being a secret communist, but he was able to survive the Whitlam government's dismissal. Now, the wizened old pugilist is interviewing the freshly graduated Anthony Albanese for a role in his office. No one else was interviewed for the position. Urin had been picked by Labour leaders to be a father figure to Albo. If you're not training your apprentices, then you're not a proper leader, says Bruce Childs, one of the leadership at the time. On the relationship that blossomed, Childs explains, and I quote, "Anthony was like Tom's fourth son, but his political son."
And this here is my political son.
This is my little political boy.
This is my little nerd that comes with me.
So Albo's mom and neighbours all come out to see Albo get picked up by a Commonwealth car on his way to the airport in Canberra.
Schmancy.
It's his first time on a plane. He's excited, he's overwhelmed, and it's a young boy in Parliament, really, who's hanging out with Tom in old Parliament House. Hearing him speak about Tom years later, the impact that he had on Albo is evident. "A spark of love unlike any other man I've known."
Okay, Queen. Hell yeah.
Yeah, I guess. So this new apprentice, he begins steeping himself in the long nights and endless paperwork of being a political lackey. But the party doesn't plan for his political convictions to be spent in middle management. Tom encourages him to travel and expand his understanding of the world, but 10 days at a Vanuatu resort isn't really enough to test Albo's mettle. In 1985, Tom engineers a harebrained scheme to throw him into the fire of international diplomacy. Albo's accompanying Tom to Vietnam, and since Albo's not a member of Parliament, he's allowed to go to Cambodia to meet the non-recognized Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, who is still the head of government in Cambodia to this day.
Oh, shit.
Albo, with the foreign minister's daughter, because she's also not...
Yeah, they're just like, well, technically, you're not
Yeah.
an employee of the state, so,
Yeah.
Fucking head on over.
They send him to Phnom Penh. It's like that, you know, They send him there to meet with Sen and come back with some notes. "We were driven in separate cars in case one of us got blown up, I think. It was pretty serious." Albo gives bad quotes.
Honestly, he...
And I mean a lot of things I'll say as, like, attacks on his character, but I don't mean this really as an attack on his character. But he just does, he gives unevocative quotes.
He's not cinematic. He's no, really not, like...
It's just like, wow.
Yeah, it sounded, it was pretty serious.
Yeah.
It's like, thanks, man. I figured.
Well, look, on the topic of serious cars, that same year, Albanese is in a Commonwealth car that gets T-boned while crossing an intersection in Narrabundah, Canberra.
No, he did. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Another car accident?
This is number two. He's knocked unconscious and he suffers a bunch of injuries this time.
Oh, shit.
So he gets another big old payout. The money, plus his savings, funds another overseas trip and the deposit on his house in his 20s. His mom had always described rent as dead money, and buying a house was a dream she'd had her whole life. He buys his first house in his 20s for $140,000 at 19% interest, which is bizarre to say at this point. And he's also wrestled control of the Young Labour from an attempted hostile takeover from the Right faction, so he's successful in the House of Parliament and the House for Living. But we have to hope that House for Living was built for two, because Anthony, who's, you know, president of Young Labour at this point, is dating the senior vice president, Joe Scard.
Ooh, scandal.
Yeah, they're called into John Della Bosca's office, an old enemy of Anthony's, who's by then the assistant secretary of the New South Wales ALP. A member of Labour Right, he did some tricky-dicky procedural magic, and suddenly it's harder for Albo to get votes for a conference. I read about this so many times, and I couldn't care enough about it. They're attacking our boy. They're attacking our
boy. Not our boy.
They're attacking our boy. Benita Mason, a member of the left faction from WA, announces she'll support anybody on the left except for Albo. They're attacking our boy.
Not our boy.
Obviously, the left faction thinks the centre and right factions have put her up to it, and how dare they stoop to this underhandedness.
It's disgusting. It's foul.
Unlike them. On the one hand, it does sound like everybody's having a good time. They realise there's a guy trying to get married in Tasmania, Andrew Mitchell. And if they can fly him in, his vote will supersede some other guy, and Albo gets to go to regionals or whatever. So, I'll quote Albo here. We fly this guy in, and we get someone to meet him at the airport, and we take him to the pub. Now, Andrew stays hidden at the pub, across the street from the office, until the moment comes for him to collect his ballot paper. They thought he wasn't coming. They thought it was over. Bang! And that's how Elbow won the vote 24-23 for something.
What the fuck?
Bang!
Bang, we got him.
Yeah.
I booked a flight for a Tasmanian.
Well, no, he was in Tasmania getting married.
Apologies.
But that's how Albo won the vote, and it doesn't matter. I promise you, it doesn't matter. The point is he won because he played with the rules like a big nerd. One of Albo's first enemies as president of Young Labour is a man he'd go on to see destroy of much of what Labour stood for. Because, according to the deputy Liberal leader at the time, ultimately, you have to create a situation where there is a decline in union membership. So, Albo's Young Labour is the vehicle to unionise the workforce of McDonald's as a way to attack the anti-worker politics of John Winston Howard, star of the Solomon Islands and deputy Liberal leader at the time.
Star of the Solomon Islands?
Yeah, this is an actual title that he holds.
What the fuck does that mean?
I don't know. There's no Solomon Islanders who have it.
Well, not good.
Albo's going up against John Howard. They're trying to unionise McDonald's to make it a thing. We get some inklings into the strategic development of Albo's public persona. A quote of his that at first made me go, and then made me go, and then with context again made me go, is his advice to anybody seeking office. You have to ask people to vote for you.
And on a technicality, he's right.
And in a metaphorical way, he's also right. It's like you have to offer people something
yeah,
to get them to vote for you. You have to actually like give them a reason to vote for you. But he does mean it specifically in, like, it's
like, this is, in a functional sense,
this is
if you want someone to vote for you on this thing, you have to say, hey, friend, will you vote for me on this thing?
Yeah. He describes this. It's described when he's door knocking as a younger person. It's described, like, in the book, the essay, is just, he asked someone to vote for him, and she's like, wow, he really spoke to that person. Anyway. So, it's, often referenced in regards to this. He's constantly showing up in communities, he meets people in his electorate. It's telling of the meat and potatoes of his strategy as well, which is his extremely good memory. After all, if a man remembers your name and situation, his request for a vote becomes something you do for a friend.
That's very true.
I clearly recall one night, a journalist said after the fact, Albo walking home from the pub reciting the names and telephone numbers of delegates.
Damn.
He's like, going home, doing little flashcards of all the people he knows.
This is that sports stats shit that's come back. He's got a new obsession. It's not just football anymore. It's like...
But it's still numbers.
It's still numbers.
He needs to have the most friends. So, Young Labour campaigns for the establishment of Western Sydney University, a university which you might notice exists. At one point, they glue all the pages from a 10,000 signature petition together and unroll it on TV. So, they do well. Albo's showing up. He's talking to delegates throughout it all. And, in 1986, he's driving his golden Holden Gemini all around country New South Wales, the golden car guaranteeing votes to continue the left's control of Young Labour. They keep the control. He takes it again by a gang of votes. He uses this term to change the name of the left faction from the Radical Leadership Group to Young Labour Left, and fully settles into political pragmatism. At this point, it says Mel Larson, who took over from Albo in 87, it became obvious that he was able not to just have conflict with the right, but work with them. I've butchered your quote, Mel. I'm so sorry. Basically, he starts working with the right, is what she says.
Okay.
Yeah. He goes on a gap year to Africa and Europe, and the book sort of implies that he cheats on Joe?
No, not on Joe.
Oh, look, it says, one of Anthony's friends let slip some of the details of his holiday to Joe and how much he'd been enjoying himself overseas.
Goodness. And if that doesn't sound like every single motherfucker who's gone on a Kentucky trip, then I don't know what does.
Look, they break up. They break up. And Joe announces it to the Young Labour women at drinks that night, which sounds so sad.
Oh, that actually what I would give to be a fly on the wall in that situation. Can you imagine the fucking power couple comes through and it's just like, ladies, it's over. Can you imagine?
Well, you know who a fly on the wall in that situation was.
Who?
A young radical firebrand of Young Labour Left, Carmel Tebbutt. She ends up deputy president of Young Labour in 88, and her and Albo start seeing each other.
Oh, shit. Yeah. All right. He's got a type.
He's got a type.
A leadership position within Young Labour.
Well, friends at the time describe her as just as serious and just as politically adept at Albo, which I'm learning to mean can count and learn names.
And hey, something to talk about, you know?
And count does he. He does, he, and doesn't he count just?
Oh, tell me about how he counts.
So, from that day on, he always knew I could count. He said once, recalling counting to 50 and establishing it was more than 43. Isn't that crazy?
I'll explain.
It's 1989, and Anthony is running for the Assistant General Secretary of the New South Wales branch of the Labour Party, which is the only left position in the Labour Party leadership, because I don't give a fuck.
Fair enough.
Albo's friends don't think they have enough votes, but he knows that he does. You don't know me very well then, if you think I'll lose, because I will win. And he does. He knows that 50 of the people that can vote are going to vote for him, which he proves by writing a list of his friends down on a napkin, the friends that end up voting for him. His mate Paul says, he's genuinely gifted with numbers.
Motherfucker can just count. What do you mean he's genuinely gifted?
Genuinely gifted.
What the fuck? He can count to 50. That's leadership material right there.
No, the crucial thing is that that's more than 43.
Sorry, apologies. He can determine the difference between two numbers.
Look, do you remember the house from earlier that he's bought?
Oh, not the parliamentary house, but the house he now lives in?
Exactly, the house in Marrickville, in the electorate of Grandler. So Grandler is a Labour right stronghold, and Albo says he was conscious of not trying to look like he was making a political move out of his personal residence. He wanted somewhere close to Marianne, and... you know, it's somewhere that Carmel's going to be moving into and they're going to be living while they enter their political and professional careers. He's Assistant General Secretary of the Labour Party. He's the only lefty in the room at Labour HQ. And he gets bullied a lot by the poor little guy. He'd also be one of the youngest staff members there, so, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah, they're all just like, oh, look at this little pussy.
Yeah, well, the myth-making at this time is wonderful. There's some wonderful lore. His predecessor was once excluded from the office Christmas party.
For what?
Because he's the only lefty, so all the lefties hold another one in his office. It gets a lot worse than that, but nobody cares to discuss exactly what happened, someone says, which I don't think it did. I think that's the worst thing that happened. But, listen, a junior staff member is rifling through Albo's office every Friday, so it is... Like
an invasive kind of, yes. Like, hey, we're going to make it hard for you to actually do your job, or we're just going to be a hindrance.
Yeah, like, I wouldn't want to go to a Christmas party with a bunch of people that I explicitly...
Fucking rifle through my shit?
Well, also, like, if I was, like, a leftist and there's a bunch of people who are, like, we're on the right, I would want to hang out with them.
Yeah, you know?
Go to a family reunion for that. So... his office is the only place he does actually have access to. He can't get to membership records, he can't get to the photocopier, he can't get to administrative equipment. They're all kept behind lock and key, and he doesn't have a key. And they're coming into his office and looking through his stuff, which they do deny, but people disagree. So, Albert does the right thing. He becomes friends with the admin staff, which, if you're trying to survive a hostile office environment, always become friends with PAs, EAs, admin. For one, they're the only living souls left in the building. For two, the same people are probably hostile for them, and for three, they're the only productive people in the building.
Very true.
There's no one else worth knowing, and they let him know when calls to him aren't being patched through, which is so rude.
Right.
And they might have something to do with him getting a key. Today, he still doesn't talk about how he got that key. He says, I just found it, as you do. He's such a fucking loser.
Whose drugs are these? I just found them. As you do.
So, in a 1991 article from the Tribune, Albo, in discussion with other Labour notables, says the Green vote at the last election was crucial to get Labour back in. That was expressing a really emerging community common sense, which the ALP had now reneged on, and it refuses to acknowledge it. So, that's an interesting take, and we'll pop it in for the time being. I'm sure it won't come up in his modern politics.
Yeah.
How you need to... get the Greens in because the community likes it.
Mm.
Look, I do need to hand one thing to him. He can use his I'm actually nerd shit to a great comic effect. So at his first meeting, when he's trying to maybe advocate for these kind of lefty policies and people already don't like him, the chair says, if anyone seconds any of Albo's motions, you're expelled. So Albo's first move is to motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
King shit. He's like, all right, motherfuckers, let's go.
He's doing all this nerd shit. However, his old tendencies to use his nerd shit for political power remain potent. He goes to his local ALP branch, the powerful and notorious The Warren branch, and nominates for secretary. The branch had been in power so long, no one else actually bothered to write in a nomination. So, because Albo knew the rules that said someone had to, he becomes secretary of a giant area which he calls a bit lucky.
Holy shit.
I just don't understand, like, if everyone in the room is in control, why don't... Like, I just don't understand what's stopping them from being like, no, actually, we're going to do it again.
Because, well, I guess that's the thing. Like, surely it's just complacency. And then, you know, this idea of, like, democracy and being like, oh, well, he did the thing. He followed the rules. Technically, we're bound by that.
That,
you know,
is just so silly.
Perhaps, like, there's just, like, at this point in time, some honor in politics. I find it difficult to believe, but...
Honor, or just, it's the fun of it. Maybe it's like, it's still a sport.
Yeah, they're just like, oh, this cheeky little guy got us.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll get him next time.
Well, it's a bit like that. His mates in the left, they're moving the fuck in while he's secretary. Harry Potter, Barry Cotter. Barry Cotter had been elected as left-wing mayor of Marrickville, ousting the right-wing's Barry Jones. Albanese's district of Grandler had been redrawn to include where he grew up in Camperdown, strengthening his hold on the area. Labour right are furious about this, and at a Young Labour meeting in 1992, the children of Labour right leaders, Nya Nya, steal the membership book. Like, they take it. and they run around. They threaten to slit Albo's throat if he tries to take it back.
Jesus Christ. I was about to be like, damn, this is some petty shit. No, this is just some... fucking insane shit.
It's both. Like, they're literally taking the membership book and running
around. Haha, we got it, and I'll fucking kill you.
And I'll fucking kill you. The member for Grandler, Leo McClay, whose son was one of the takeovers, had to take heed of his upstart enemy, because there was a lot of noise on the ground, but Leo's not worried. He's part of the most powerful faction in government. A group of power brokers and hard men. The Mates.
The Mates.
They're called the Mates. This is what they are called.
Just a fucking pack of mates, eh?
Yeah. The mates include the Prime Minister, Paul Keating.
Okay.
The most evil man I've ever seen, Gareth Evans.
Ugh.
President of the ALP, Stephen Loosely, and Graham Richardson, a kingmaker who was about to be kicked out of Parliament. This dude.
Okay.
I love this story. He's friends with Carrie Packer, and so there's whispers of organized crime connections. And he's used his political money to get his cousins out of trouble in the Marshall Islands.
Okay.
And he sticks around forever just being... Yeah, that's them. That's the police coming right now to pick up Graham Richardson. Weird looking guy. I'll
fucking
show you a little
done,
picture
Graham.
Of him. We might cover him one day. I think he's still around when I was looking at it. Yeah, he's still around. He's getting on. But he was in the Hawke and Keating governments. He's now in the media. This guy...
Oh my god.
Yeah, he's so powerful.
I don't know what I expected him to look like, but I think he just shocked me.
Yeah, he's a interesting story, I suppose. He got really fucked up a few times. Anyway, that guy. So, he's been kicked out of Parliament.
Yeah.
So there's a free seat. There's a vacancy, a casual vacancy. And the left calls in a previous agreement to get the next vacancy. You know, they have some kind of pre-agreement where it's like, all right, next vacancy, the left gets it. And then the one after that, the right gets it.
Okay.
This is how electoral politics and representative politics works at the end of the day. It just comes down to like, well, this is our rule.
It's my turn.
It's just house rules. It's like electric wiki for the country. So they want the seat of Grandler, and Anthony ensures that it goes to the left's old stalwart, Jeanette McHugh. So Leo is out. He goes to the neighbouring electorate of Watson. I don't know. It might come up later. As compensation, Leo gets to be the government whip.
What is that?
We'll get to it.
Okay.
But he's the whip.
Okay, he's the whip.
He gets to be the whip.
He's the fucking whip.
Because he gave up his seat for Jeanette. Albo puts his little albicles in every corner he can reach. A favour here, support there. The book notes that he gets on the ground floor of more than a few women's political careers, apparently in a very normal way. Want to be clear? Very normal way. And they owe him support for the rest of their lives. So, it's time to take a swipe at a bigger figure. Stephen Loosely, the president of the ALP, and the idiot who bought a $3.8 million building to celebrate Labour's centenary, only to find it worth less than half of that and needing $1 million of upgrades.
Jesus.
This was contributing to debts that meant at least $1.5 million hadn't been paid to council members. After resigning from his previous post, he received its salaries for another 2 months. For comparison, it took my first big employer, the Australian National University, 4 months to even pay me at all for the first time they hired me, let alone after they fired me. Anyway, look, the Left and Albo are campaigning very publicly for Loosely's resignation under these corruption allegations. He'd received a $99,000 severance payment, $30,000 in ongoing salary, and a huge leave balance to be paid out. Because he didn't take any leave. All of his overseas travel was for study tours and was thus paid time.
Right.
What are you talking about? And he kept earning his salary as a senator during that time.
That's fucking silly. But of course, I mean, what do you expect?
So the right is sending of the mates, Graham Richardson. He's still running ground operations as a power broker. And he's trying to negotiate a you stay quiet and we'll drop Loosely later. Albo, come, like, just relax. Let him get out. We'll shuffle him out, get him his payments. So Graham is pissing in a meeting room bathroom when he hears some voices outside the door. No, I'm serious. He hears Albo and his mates discussing the plans to tell him to fuck off. And so he comes out and they're like, oh, Graham, well, I guess you heard us. Listen, if Loosely doesn't resign today, we'll make things worse. So
that is a scene from every, like, 2000s high school movie.
Right?
Like, the fucking kid in the bathroom.
Is the kid they're talking shit about.
They're all just like, oh my god, can you believe? That's insane. That's honestly so funny.
Well, listen, Loosely resigns and the right take this in the rational adult way they always conduct themselves.
Oh no.
So Albo's gone to a post-election study tour of the US and he's found that his corner office has been converted to a library.
Right.
At some point in this book, it doesn't matter where, somebody describes Albanese like this. If you think you're 3 steps ahead, he's 10 steps ahead.
And Albanese could tell you for a fact that's a difference of 7. 10 is bigger than 3.
He's genuinely gifted with numbers. In front of cameras and before the office is properly opened, Albo, Carmel, and some union presidents show up to dismantle the library and fix Albo's office. The right retreat into, this is a joke that got out of hand, and Albo's happy to let it slide. There's no need for a meeting. It's fixed. It's done. Move it, and I'll move it back, is what he says. From the incident, he gets a reputation amongst the Labour right members as being a more normal person who's able to take a joke, gaining respect from Graham Richardson, who was going to make me throw up. We play hard when we have to. Why not? It's a hard game. It's not a game for weaklings, and Albo, the young left warrior and a good one, was a worthy opponent. He had real balls, Albo. He had real balls.
As opposed to those fucking fake balls that I see so much of.
There's so many fake balls in Parliament.
So many fake goddamn balls.
At least Albo has real balls.
I just want balls that taste like real balls.
Whatever part of the left Albo's aligned with, he certainly doesn't come in to the Labour Party with any friends in Labour, right? But he gains their respect and whatever. This kind of gets to the thesis of the podcast in general, which is you cannot take this shit seriously.
Yeah, he's just out here making mates and everyone's like, that sounds like a good leader. That sounds like a prime minister to me.
He's making mates, they're fixing his office. He brings cameras to watch him fix it. Like, this is the behind the scenes tomfoolery that decides who runs the country. But it should still make you angry because this is the bullshit that decides who gets to withhold aid from Palestinians under genocide or whatever. It's politics. Politics is about being the best at assessing who your mate is. I remember asking Albo if he thought my opponent had enough numbers, and he said yes, said Luke Foley, running for something or other. And he could always count, and I thought he was probably right, so I backed off. And it's about being the best at establishing the behind-the-scenes drama and myth-making that provides the public with a lovable captain to root for. It used to be fairly bare-knuckled fighting stuff, says the first guy's opponent that we mentioned. And it's about airport noise. And that is a topic we will touch next week. Karen, what are you thinking about Albo at this point?
Honestly, I'm torn between, like, this is I feel like this is like the start of a movie where you're like, oh, it's a villain origin story in a way. I don't think Albanese's a villain, but it's kind of like that idea of like you see the entire history building towards what you know them as now, you know? Like this is Anthony Albanese is like Maleficent, you know? Anthony Albanese is wicked, you know?
Anthony Albanese is under a house.
You know? Like it just feels like it's really interesting. I'm curious to see where else it goes. I mean, most of the stuff that I have to talk about is a lot more modern stuff, you know. While he's still a private citizen, I suppose, obviously there's not a whole lot of media coverage on him.
No, there wasn't. There was pretty much this one book that Karen Middleton wrote. And, like, it was a nice book.
There's a couple of little articles when he's in Young Labour and stuff like that where he, you know, mostly in kind of like leftist news media, sometimes into mainstream news media, he'll get a little mention like, oh, and the president of blah, blah, blah said Labor, this. Yeah. And it'll just be like a line being like, we think we're going to win the election. And like nothing really concrete or super interesting.
No.
But there's yeah, some that does change in the future. So I'm keen to get it to does. That.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we'll be covering his time like in coming up to this election. So the election we just talked about, Jeanette McHugh, she gets in, that's 93, and then a bunch of things happen. And we'll be starting again in 96, where Albo's going to be in the election this time. So we'll be getting to the start of his actual, like, political career. But at this point, we've got a 30-ish-year-old kid, essentially, who's been an adult his whole life, and his mom's still around at this point. He's having a good time. It's the mid-90s, he's probably listening to, I actually don't, look, because this is, I think, the most positive we'll feel about Albo, I'm going to leave with the thing I agree with him about most, which is that he doesn't respect Toto as a band.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not a Toto fan,
and I gotta agree with him there.
You know, I feel definitely a sense of some, not quite relatability, but familiarity with the person that he is. I know people like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, that makes sense to me. A lot of the times when I see a politician, particularly, I guess, as they've been in politics for a long time, I have no fucking clue what that person would have been like as a child.
No.
I'm like, who the fuck is this? How did you exist the way you are? But this all makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. Like, you know, it's a strange feeling. It's a very strange feeling.
It is, and we've mainly heard from Albo, essentially, because Garen didn't really challenge him much during this book. And, you know, I listened to an interview he did with Neil Mitchell, who interviews everyone he listens. I listened to a Dutton interview of his, and he challenges him a little, but not really.
Yeah.
Like, so we haven't... the most critical thing which we hear about young Albo kind of come from Julia Gillard. And they specifically disagree about, you know, an issue that was central to Young Labour at the time. And yeah, on the topic of Young Labour, we haven't really talked about the Labour left, hard left, hard soft left, factionalism stuff, but it's all happening behind the scenes. It's not very interesting, because it just seems
goofy. It's just goofy
going
shit
to different things with different people and getting their friends. But yeah, and we'll get back to some goofy shit in a couple, in a week. By then, who knows what Albo will have done in the meantime. We're recording this in early, mid-November. There was stuff in the news saying that Albo might call an election soon. So by the time you hear this,
hey, we'll know.
Yeah. But for now, have a wonderful rest of your week, and we will see you next time. Bye, Karen.
Bye, Yanni.